Hello, everyone. Tom Slater here. We've got another brilliant episode of Last Orders for you today with Big Brother Watch's director, Silky Carlo. But before we get into that, I just want to say a huge thank you to everyone who's been leaving us their ratings and their reviews. It's a really great way to help the show, and it takes just 30 seconds on your podcast app. So if you haven't done so already, go and leave us one right now. Just make sure that you come back and listen to the rest of the podcast and make sure that your star ratings and your write-ups are glowing so as to push us up the algorithm. Also, thank you for your post-bag questions. We're really enjoying them on the show as ever. So if you've got a question that you're burning to ask me or Christopher, you can send it to lastorders@spiked-online.com, or you can tweet at us or Facebook us or whatever. Anyway, that's enough from me. Thanks so much. And now on with the show. Welcome to Last Orders, the Spike podcast all about freedom and the nanny state. In this episode, we discuss the government's war on lockdown skeptics, the madness of the WHO, and Nicola Sturgeon's nannying legacy. Hello and welcome to Last Orders. I'm Tom Slater, editor of Spiked, joined as I am in every episode by Chris Snowden from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Hello, Chris. How are you doing?
I'm all right, Tom. All the better for seeing you.
I'm glad I can have such a sunny impact on your life. We'd like to be joined in this episode by Silky Carlo. Silky is the director of Big Brother Watch. We've got a fascinating new report that we're going to get into in a second. But Silky, thanks so much for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk about a lot today, but we want to start off with your report, Silky, which came out last month, which was looking into this subject of how the government, the state, were keeping tabs on and even reporting dissenters on the COVID and lockdown and vaccine passports question to the big tech companies. Reading it, I was shocked but not surprised. I think probably a lot of people have had that response, because what you lay out is terrifying, but also I think a lot of people kind of suspected that a lot of this was going on. So without wanting to overly kind of simplify what was going on, but in a kind of nutshell, what is it that you and your colleagues found at Big Brother Watch? What was going on in 2020 and 2021 that concerned you so much?
We found that there were a number of secretive government units that claimed to be fighting disinformation online, but that were actually, at least in large part, monitoring and recording critics of big COVID policies. And that included members of parliament, world-leading academics, journalists, campaigners, and these people's views were being compiled in reports that were sent up to central government and then in some cases flagged to social media companies. So they were particularly interested if something could be construed as a breach of terms of service on one of the big platforms so that stuff could be taken down. So, you know, really we've kind of got the truth police distributed across government. They work in several policy units, but we also found that this secretive part of the British Army, the 77th Brigade, had been deployed to basically do the same, to be scouring Twitter in particular for kind of what they call sentiment analysis, getting a view on what the public were thinking about policies at different times. And this is a unit that is, you know, it's a significant military resource that's supposed to be used for non-lethal, thank God, engagements with hostile states and kind of psychological information warfare. But, you know, seems on the back of our research, the British public is deemed as a threat to our government.
And as far as you can tell, is this something which was brought in because of COVID, that was supercharged because of COVID? Was this kind of surveillance not just of kind of the propaganda put out by foreign states, but actually, you know, journalists, people in civil society, citizens themselves? As far as you can tell, and I know it's a very shady world, this sort of thing, was this something that was new or at least kind of sped up by that kind of climate that the pandemic brought in?
There was COVID was definitely a catalyst for what these units were doing. And I think the whole kind of counter disinformation industry as well. And the notion that we should be paying people to be truth arbiters and we should be censoring people for wrongthink. But actually some of these units popped up around Brexit. But there definitely was an expansion during COVID, and now this is a permanent capability across government. Mm-hmm. So some of the units that we looked at were stood up and then stood down, but the personnel are now across government. In terms of the army deployment, our understanding is that they operated for a number of months during the pandemic. What they're now doing, we don't know, but we should have a degree of distrust, and we certainly should be questioning them about what they could be working on. Lots of other controversial topics in the press and controversial policy areas, you know, how are we to now know how much the narrative is being guided by civil servants operating in the shadows with this massive new blank check that exists in government?
I'll bring in Chris in a sec, but just before that, what response, if any, have you got from the government to your revelations? I'm sure you asked for responses. As I understand it, was a lot of freedom of information requests and subject access requests and so on. So this is information that they've given you, or be it kind of through gritted teeth. What response, if any, have you got from the departments and the state more broadly from what you found out?
Yeah, well, first, to say something about how we got this information, with great difficulty. I mean, it was really, really hard to get freedom of information requests they were not responding to. So the main way that we got this information is going to people that we thought might be affected, some of the big critics, Peter Hitchens, David Davis, the MP, Professor Carl Hennigan, for instance, and asking them to do subject access requests, which is when you can get a copy of all of the data about you that a department holds. And that's how we found these records. In terms of official responses, there was no denial of the activity. Government effectively defended what we had exposed. And in fact, what was really interesting is that the Defence Secretary volunteered a statement to the Commons saying that the 77th Brigade was involved in assessing UK disinformation, and that he'll look into what exactly the activities were, and that they shouldn't be involved in policing opinions. The reason that's so significant is because at the time of the deployment of the 77th Brigade resource, there was a public statement saying that the 77th Brigade has never and would never conduct operations in relation to Brits, as you would expect. You know, the army is not designed to treat its own citizens as the enemy. So that's really, really, you know, we've got a full 360 U-turn through that statement from government saying, yes, the army was deployed to look at speech, lawful speech by people in the UK online. Now we want the investigations. So we've asked the Defence Committee, although the chair of the Defence Committee is Tobias Elwood, who's also a reservist for the 77th Brigade. So if they do an inquiry, he may need to recuse himself. But the Defence Committee should be doing an inquiry into this. DCMS Committee should do an inquiry. The Intelligence and Security Committee should have oversight. These are, you know, spook-like activities, and they've said themselves they should have oversight of this stuff. We also have asked Elon Musk to publish all correspondence between the UK government and Twitter. Let's get everything out into the open. Let's have all the documents. Let's have a look at exactly what was happening and make sure that it never happens again.
Chris, what's your response to these revelations? Were you shocked at all that this sort of thing was going on? Or
In a way I was, yeah. I mean, I was shocked as much as anything by this the waste of money involved. And also, you know, because with the exception of the infamous 77th, this was all going to private companies. And well over £1 million, wasn't it? And I noticed one of the companies that got a big chunk of it is called Logically, who we may have mentioned before on the podcast. I can't remember. Logically sort of fact-checked an article I wrote for Spiked about the COVID and smoking thing a while ago. I can't remember if we mentioned it on the show. I wrote about it on my Substack anyway. And the fact check was just awful. I mean, the guy just Googled for a few things that suited his argument and said, look, you know, based on this website from 2.5 years ago, there isn't enough evidence to say either way. So I'm not very impressed with the people that they commissioned to do it. But also, I mean, all they were doing was just going on Twitter. Right? I mean, Peter Hitchens wasn't having his, you know, phone tapped or something. I wasn't having his car tail. They were just going on, and seeing, you know, the dumbass opinions that Peter Hitchens was putting out freely to the entire world. And anyone could have done it. I could have done it. I mean, we're all sat at home over lockdown, you know, and if anything like me, spending a huge amount of time on Twitter. I've been, you know, picking up misinformation from people on Twitter about COVID for the last 2 years, but I haven't been sending a memo to government about it. I've just been quote tweeting them and going, look at this moron. So it seems to me a massive waste of money. It'd be interesting to know what the... interested to know more about what the government actually did once they got this information. But the information itself seemed incredibly simple to get hold of. It's creepy, without a shadow of a doubt. It's also a waste of money. Obviously, it shouldn't have happened. It shouldn't be happening. And it'd be very interesting to know, you know, how much more is happening. Also, very interesting to know who else has been catalogued in this way. Because as you say, Silky, you can only get the people if they did it themselves. So we only know, you know, people like Julia, a friend of the show, Julia Hartley-Brewer, and people who volunteered to do it. But presumably it was far more extensive than this. Mm. I'd love to know what these memos were saying about someone like Ivor Cummings or something like that.
Well, it seemed to go far beyond that as well, because, I mean, reading the report, Silky, it was striking that a lot of the things that were, for instance, being flagged as in some way kind of anti-vax were often just anti-vaccine passport. Yeah. So that's a kind of moral political position you might come to with having had no look at the data necessarily, or even just a rough understanding. It wasn't necessarily just about this person has found some dodgy study which they're half understanding and then tweeting out to their audience. It was about just being against government policy.
Yeah, so it was already public that some of these units were active and doing counter misinformation. But our suspicion was that it wasn't misinformation that they were looking at. And regrettably, that suspicion has been confirmed. Vaccine passports is a great example. Why was there so much on David Davis? I mean, a lot of what he said, I think everything that he said checked out. And the statements of his that were being collected were about vaccine passports. Same for me. There was quite a lot on me and some of the stuff that I was doing in the media, and it was all about vaccine passports. Same with Julia. Julia Hartley-Brewer couldn't have said more times that she herself was vaccinated, she supported the vaccination program, etc. David Davis was very careful to say that, others. And this is the thing. It's the political thread that runs through this and the political power that runs through this. This was aimed at stigmatizing and silencing. It has a distinct political bent to it. The whole purpose was to take, I can't say the purpose, the product I can say, was to take criticism that was attracting a large audience and to interpret it in a way where it, in the language that they use, fed into a narrative. And a narrative that's associated with mis or disinformation or misinformation, basically that it's not true. If you look at vaccine passports, at the time, we were being told by governments and ministers across the four nations and across the world, in fact, that a vaccine passport or a COVID pass was absolutely critical to us having our freedom back. It was the freedom pass. It was going to save lives. That there was lots of evidence that it was saving lives and could save lives and all these kinds of things. And we were also being told that if you were vaccinated, of course, you couldn't get COVID, you couldn't pass it on, all this kind of stuff. This never appears in the misinformation reports. We now know it's not true. Big Brother Watch brought legal challenges in Wales and against the UK government for the mandatory domestic COVID pass schemes. And we have in black and white in government documents that they knew that COVID passes would not have any measurable or significant impact on the public health situation. Seems to be something that was more somewhere between a punt and a psychological exercise. So was it about misinformation? Was it about this dogmatic mantra of following the science? No, it was about protecting a political decision and a political direction, and using the power of being able to call something misinformation and disinformation to discredit it and ultimately to suppress it. You know, this was the purpose of the record keeping. It was not for fun. You know, they have these units have trusted flagger status, and you've got the likes of Chris Philp at the time was a minister in DCMS, Nadine Dorry, saying in Parliament, every single day we are contacting the social media companies through the counter disinformation unit, these units that we've been exposing, and telling them to take this stuff down, inappropriate content, content that shouldn't be on the internet. The missing piece that we have is we don't know yet exactly what those bits of content were.
Mm-hmm.
That's obviously something we want to find out in the investigation. It's something Elon Musk can help with. But that was the purpose of what they were doing. And we do know that David Davis had his speech against vaccine passports censored because it was on our channel and they took it down until we got it reinstated, kicked up a fuss. Peter Hitchens had what he suspects was shadow banning. Professor Carl Hennigan, Center for Evidence-Based Medicine, one, you know, world-leading expert, had one of these chumps, probably from Logically or somewhere else, say that what he was writing was false after a, you know, a cursory Google search. So yeah, big problems here with government controlling mm-hmm. the information sphere at a time when it should have been completely free, and that was the way that, you know, people were also going to be able to trust the information that they were receiving. Now we know it was heavily controlled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it comes back to the old problem of, you know, who decides what disinformation is. And one of the interesting things in your report, which I do recommend people read, by the way, is, look, there has been a huge amount of disinformation over the last 3 years about COVID and vaccines especially. But a lot of the stuff, most of the stuff probably, or most of the examples that you give in the report at least, were just people saying, maybe the lockdown shouldn't be going on this long.
Yeah.
Maybe vaccine passports are a bad idea. Or in fact, that vaccine passports are unethical, perfectly reasonable positions that I myself held. And also, by the way, you know, if their job is to get, you know, disinformation taken off the internet, it's clearly been singularly ineffective in this respect. Mm. And they are challenging people's perfectly valid opinions. But certainly when you're dealing with genuinely and very obviously legitimate debates about policy, then there's no case for the army in investigating it. It comes back, I don't know if you've seen the thing about Reason magazine recently, have you? So Reason, we had Nick Gillespie on the show a few months ago. He's the editor of Reason magazine, libertarian magazine in America. It's actually been checked by something called NewsGuard, like rated as one of the best. It's got the highest ranking for trustworthy news. It's a very reputable magazine. It's got a heavy libertarian slant, but in terms of its journalism, it's very well regarded. But then something, I think it's called the Global Disinformation Index. Have you heard of this? It's a British organization. They've ranked them right at the very bottom. And they've got, you know, all the sites ranked at the bottom are either conservative or libertarian, and all the sites at the top are like Huffington Post and BuzzFeed and, you know, left-leaning ones. And now there's no disinformation on Reason. They've got a view, you know, they've got an opinion that probably people who work for this organization don't agree with. And so they get rated, you know, with an E.
Mm.
Purely for political reasons. And I mean, I don't know how you get around that, because these things are always going to be subjective. These organizations set themselves up. Who knows what the Global Disinformation Index is really, you know? And therefore, the answer is not to really do it in the first place.
Right? I think the problem is those fact checkers also get laundered through their work with government. They get laundered through their work with big tech companies, as you were saying, about this organization that checked your article being one of their kind of outsourced fact checkers. Another thing that I've got some knowledge of is the way in which you have advertising as well, as one thing that crops up a lot. So you get a lot of magazines, again, if you dissent on the issues of the day, it has nothing to do with how reputable your journalism is, now sticking to the facts, you find yourself on fake news lists and so on and so forth, which directly impacts your revenue. So this is something which seems to, whether we're talking about business or whether we're talking about government, it's just everywhere because this industry has cropped up. But it does strike me, because I mean, conspiracy theories abounded, you know, over the COVID years. There's no two ways about that. But you can't help but feel like that was fueled by a lot of this activity. I'm not trying to suggest that if someone's silenced on Twitter that they're going to instantly decide that they believe everything that David Icke has ever said or whatever. But it is.
Well, they said they were being followed by 77 Brigade, and it turns out some of them have. So, you know, that particular conspiracy theory had a bit of legs, didn't it?
But, you know, you can't help but feel that not only the environment of lockdown sent a lot of people crazy, depriving people of their liberties for that long and not having any sense of when they were going to come out of it, but also finding that when they wanted to speak up about that.
Well, what do you do if you're a sensible person who lived through this extraordinary period? And I accept there'll be different views around this table mm-hmm. about the decisions that were taken. But that's the point. You should be able to have them and discuss them. If you're someone who felt that during that period that the government was at times being psychologically manipulative, that we were being told one story, that the public was being told one story that people internally didn't believe in the same way, it was they were partying nonstop and all the rest of it, having affairs, you know, and if you felt that, as they were, kind of the rule of law was thrown out of the window, parliamentary democracy was put on pause, kind of whole foundation of the liberal democracy that defines Britain was went to shit, and you had no stewardship for how to process it because the BBC was giving PowerPoint presentations on how to hug safely, genuinely, where do you go? I have so much empathy for people that have gotten a bit lost during this period who don't live in the Westminster bubble like we perhaps do, where, you know, at least we, there were conversations being had and, you know, alarms being raised. But if you're just, if your engagement with politics is through the institutions that we should be able to trust and that should give some clear-headed analysis, it wasn't there. You know, there was no clear-headed analysis and a kind of objective analysis about what was going on. There was just preaching. There was just a reinforcement of the government's message, whether it was on the BBC or Twitter or Facebook, and you're seeing academics being silenced and suppressed and your favourite columnist and from the paper and all this kind of stuff. It is very disorientating. Mm. And the reason now that trust in those institutions has plummeted is no one's fault but those institutions. They haven't earned the trust, they've lost it, and they deserved to. But how do we go from there? Because, you know, now there is a real problem.
No, I completely agree with that. Also, I think just being deprived from the rest of society, from socialising and stuff, that has a way of kind of taking the edges off of some of the crazy things some people might be saying otherwise. We've got a lot more to talk about, and I want to move on to talk about Nicola Sturgeon. By a bit of a quirk of scheduling, this is actually coming out about a week after we're recording this. We're recording this in a couple of days after her resignation. But, you know, unless she does something crazy, like calls for an armed insurrection or whatever, I think her legacy is pretty much set at this point. So, of course, she stepped down earlier this week, kind of came out of nowhere, although the writing of the wall has been there for some time. And what I'd like to talk about, given this is a podcast all about the nanny state and civil liberties, is Nicola Sturgeon or the SNP sort of record on a lot of those questions. I think it's fair to say that Scotland over the past 10 or 15 years has been a bit of a world leader in a lot of illiberal policies. Some of the nanny state stuff you'll talk about, Chris, hate crime legislation during COVID, a very enthusiastic lockdown state, as well as some things that people tend to forget around parenting and all this sort of thing. But just to kick things off, Chris, given this is a nanny state podcast, how are you feeling that Nicola Sturgeon has gone? Do you have any confidence that the kind of Scottish nanny state will be at all damaged by this, or will it carry on without her? Do you want to also just give us a bit of a sense of what has happened under her watch, I guess?
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm glad she's going. I just don't like her, really. It's nothing, you know, it's not even about politics particularly. Yeah. I mean, I don't really care about
pure personal
Scottish independence. I think in a way it'd be quite a good laugh. But I just don't like her. She's just the kind of person I've spent all my life trying to avoid. Do you know what I mean? There's something about her. Well, I don't mean a woman or Scottish, but just that kind of bad person. I'm trying to think of a Scottish woman I do like now. Hazel Irvine, the snooker presenter. And Gloria Hunterford, was she Scottish? Is she Scottish? I don't know. Point is, I don't hate her just because she's a Scottish woman.
Good to know.
I just don't like people like her. She's always come across to me like a bit of a snake. I think that's what annoys me. Because the SNP, let's face it, is basically a pressure group. It's not really a political party. It's a pressure group. And their only reason for winning elections is to put more pressure on the government. You know, so that's part of the reason they've governed Scotland so badly, because they only really care about one thing. Mm. And she only cares about one thing. So whatever it is, she will bring round in some way.
Well, at least
in a very cynical way.
It's independence and rapists and women's prisons, if we're going to be.
Well, this other stuff, I think, is largely just to put clear blue water between Scotland and England. Right. So I think a lot of the nanny state stuff was just adopted just because, well, we're going to be a world leader, right? Minimum price, we'll be the first country to do it. The eyes of the world are looking at Scotland. But also Westminster hasn't done it, and we're going to do it. And the fact that every policy that sets a bit of distance between Scotland and England happens to be deeply illiberal or authoritarian and a terrible idea, it isn't really of a great concern to her. I think it's much more important just to create a distinction. So specific policies, minimum pricing obviously was really the big one, because nobody else has been daft enough to try that anywhere in the world. And that has failed fairly catastrophically. There was a report from the government, from Public Health Scotland anyway, only a couple of weeks ago, saying that 22% of Scots who live within an hour's drive of the border have travelled to England solely to buy alcohol. Solely. not just like gone to England and brought back a bit of whiskey on the way, but driven there. And even if you're an hour's drive away, that's still a drive. Mm. You're not going there for a bottle of whiskey. You're going to go and fill up the entire car / van, aren't you? So that's how happy people are with minimum pricing in Scotland. And there's various other, mainly temperance policies, banning like 2-for-1 deals with wine. That didn't work. Lowering the drink driving limit. That definitely didn't work. 2 studies have evaluated this. So it's not just my opinion these things don't work. It's the opinion of people in mm-hmm. public health academia who supported them in the first place. It's going, actually, it didn't make any difference whatsoever. I think didn't she ban like 2-for-1 deals on pizzas as well?
That was certainly mooted at one point.
I mean, I know we're going to do that in England soon, but I think pretty sure they did that. Didn't they? I don't know. Anyway, it's the kind of thing she would do. That's the point, isn't it?
Because she's a snake.
So good riddance to her. But I don't see any hope from anybody else.
So that's a lot of the nanny state stuff that we've been talking about. Silky, I'm not sure if Big Brother Watch have any run-ins with Holyrood or Scotland over a lot of these things, but is there anything that you would kind of pick out, whether it was the hate crime bill or anything else that would have particularly concerned you over recent years about what's been going on up there?
Yeah, there have been some concerning policy directions, actually, like, you know, hate crime, criminalising what you can say around your kitchen table. There have been some concerning things. I agree. I think that the impetus seemed to be to take a different route to Westminster on a lot of issues. And that is the reason, actually, I think most of the lobbying that we did that was Scotland specific was during COVID. Mm-hmm. And I think it's now coming out in the diaries that, you know, a lot, sometimes major significant decisions were taken in a different way in Scotland, where they wanted to be the first to go further with the masks, and Boris is trying to catch up, right, then we'll do COVID passports, mm-hmm. or, you know, trying to like out authoritarian each other for political reasons. And that's, I think now we are having a bit of a reckoning about how many serious decisions were taken for purely political reasons rather than public health reasons. What an interesting legacy for her. I think one thing that has to be said about Sturgeon is she's such a formidable politician, though. You know, even though she's not likable by a lot of people in the press, or perhaps personally by a lot of people that have worked with her, but I don't think anyone could doubt that she's a formidable politician.
She failed, didn't she? She only had one policy and she didn't achieve it.
I mean, she came as close, perhaps, as it was possible to come to achieving that one policy. And, you know.
So the thing that undid her in the end, right, was this trans...
We should talk about this, the gender recognition reform. She,
you really think that was
through.
It?
I think so.
It was certainly...
By the timing.
It was. It can't help but have been the spark, certainly. I think it also just kind of copper-fastened a lot of other things that were going wrong. But I think just... Nicola Sturgeon, as you say, a kind of reputation as a very formidable politician, really having a kind of grip on her brief, being very unflappable. Not only did those reforms, which as many people are now aware, led to situations like, again, rapists being admitted to women's prisons, that had already been going on, but this would have effectively kind of formalised the process, if you like. Not only just struck most people as mad, I think, but also she was both doubling down on it, but also incapable of defending it at the same time. So you would have these situations where this unflappable politician couldn't answer basic questions like, is this kind of rapist and so on.
It only took a little bit of probing for the whole thing just to tumble down, really, didn't it?
I think a lot of this stuff is like that, just the tiniest bit of actual scrutiny and attention. Yeah. Not something that's going on in the background, not something that's just being signed off by civil servants no one talks about, actually being debated in public. It crumbles quite quickly.
Because these hard cases were obviously always going to come around, right? And all these interviews had to say is, well, you know, you think these people are women, so why are you sending them to a men's prison? And she'd go, well, yeah, but it's different. They're not different women. So these are women sex offenders. So, Laura, do you normally send women sex offenders to men's prison? Are there any other women prisoners in a men's prison? Goes, no. So what's different about these ones? The other ones haven't got dicks, basically. That was the difference. But she couldn't quite say that, so she just resigned.
It was striking how much this, because especially when she started to double down on this particular policy, because obviously you had Westminster invoke this Section 35 order of the government, I should say, to block it on the grounds that it would interfere with equalities legislation south of the border. So potentially you could get a Scottish gender recognition certificate, which is a lot easier to get, and then, you know, end up in a prison in England and demand to go in the women's estate and so on. So it was on those grounds. And she thought that surely she must have known this policy was unpopular, it was opposed by about 2/3 of Scots and so on, that this would be something that at least on principle she could use to drive a wedge between Scots and Westminster. It worked in completely the other way around. It made people far more sympathetic to what the Westminster government was trying to do in terms of stopping it. And it made her look even more mad for continuing to pursue it. So it was, in that sense, I think it shows that this issues like this, which are often dismissed as a culture war and something that people gin up, and there's a lot of very online people who care about it a lot, but really people in society don't. I think this is a perfect example of the fact that people do actually care about it, and it can even bring down politicians who seemed for a long time to be unassailable. It's not the only thing that did it for her, definitely, but you can't help but think it was significant.
I think the extent to which that could be a devolved decision was certainly a sticking point that wasn't going to pan out, isn't going to pan out well for the SNP. I mean, even there's a lot of legal expertise behind that criticism, of course, as well. Shami Chakrabarty has said, although that she sympathises with the SNP policy, that she recognises that the impact would be felt across the United Kingdom. I think ultimately this has been it's been so badly handled, and she was so ill-prepared for these questions in this situation, even though politicians like Johanna Cherry, these were precisely the cases and the questions that they have been raising for years and being vilified as a result. If I remember correctly, it was on the day when somebody was charged for sending Johanna Cherry violent threats that she was dropped from the front bench by Sturgeon. So, you know, this has been a really sad period for women in politics. And it's also bad for trans rights that this debate and this bad handling is what is now, when people talk about trans rights or trans issues, it is these big issue, you know, it's about rapists, right. Mm-hmm. Is what people are thinking about, you know, and about these really badly handled and you know, misguided statements, etc. It's worked out well for absolutely no one.
Mm-hmm. Can I make a prediction here, Tom?
Please do.
I predict that within a year or two, Jacinda or Nicola, or quite possibly both of them, will be working for either the World Health Organization or for one of Mike Bloomberg's front groups.
I think that's a pretty safe bet.
Public health. Sturgeon already is on some Bloomberg panel about syntaxes, but pro-syntax organization. Mm-hmm. Helen Clark, one of Jacinda Ardern's predecessors, is also on that panel. These are exactly the kind of people. They're both nanny statists, basically. Mm-hmm. Jacinda said, right, we're going to ban smoking, then resigned. It was the last act, effectively. Yeah. She said, we're going to ban tobacco sales. And Sturgeon, obviously, has always wanted to get the love of the likes of the WHO. So I bet quite possibly both of them will have cushy jobs with the WHO, with Bloomberg, within a couple of years.
Should we stay on the WHO?
Yes. Oh, nice segue.
There we go. But let's talk about a story that you picked up to talk about this time around, Chris, which is about the WHO and its anti-vax activism. Yeah. Do you want to tell us a bit more about this?
It's an amazing story. I can't believe it hasn't been picked up more by the British press. So try and cut this short. Canada doesn't have any homegrown COVID vaccines. It has been working on one for quite some time through a company whose name escapes me, begins with M, but it's a Canadian company. And they've been using what's been described as a plant similar to tobacco, which isn't actually tobacco. Tobacco happens to be very good for making vaccines. There's quite a few vaccines come from tobacco. Don't ask me why, but it is quite good for producing vaccines. And this has come from a tobacco-like plant. And the company that's been developing it is partly owned by Philip Morris, the big tobacco giant. It's only got a 21% stake, but it does have a shareholding in it. The vaccine has been approved by Health Canada. Two doses is about 70% effective against Omicron, which is pretty good going. It's quite cheap. The technology can be used for all sorts of things, potentially, rather like the mRNA vaccines. Potentially, it can be used for cancer and other diseases. But the WHO has a policy of not engaging with the tobacco industry. That there's a global tobacco treaty, which Canada and most countries have signed, which basically says that the tobacco industry shouldn't be involved in public health policy around smoking, which is a reasonable thing, I suppose. But it's been massively gold-plated over the years, and people, particularly anti-smoking groups, try and portray it as saying you must not have any contact with the tobacco industry under any circumstances ever. Including in this instance, the gold plating has gone so far as for the WHO to say, well, we're not going to approve this drug, this vaccine, because Philip Morris has a minority shareholder in it. So the vaccine has effectively been killed off. They can still use it in Canada if they want, but the idea was to put it out around the world. It's relatively cheap, quite good for the developing countries. But it is effectively killed off the vaccine. The company that makes it has now gone bust or is about to go bust with a loss of 600 jobs. The technology will be lost forever, probably. And it's this insane quasi-religious impulse of the WHO where, you know, it really is sort of are we the baddies territory, isn't it? When the WHO is stopping people getting access to a vaccine for COVID purely because it makes them feel better to say, oh, we're not going to have anything to do with the tobacco industry. The tobacco industry just makes no difference to the tobacco industry whether this thing is approved or not, other than I guess Philip Morris might make a little bit of money. But it's not like this is some way in for Philip Morris to suddenly start lobbying the Canadian government or governments worldwide going like, oh, do you know we've got 21% stake in this vax? It's madness, but it's this cult mentality, this absolute fanaticism within the WHO. Which is another reason why it should be shut down.
There we go. I'm not sure if you've got anything to say on WHO, Silky, because one story I do want to cram in quickly is this one that you point out in your blog, Chris. Brings us back to Scotland for a second. Yeah. Can you just tell us about this individual and his campaign against McDonald's, just because I think some of our nannies...
Yes, cracking story.
Short version, if you will, just because I want to get to the point.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay. A bloke has set up a petition, an online petition, calling for fast food promotions to be banned because he doesn't like the Monopoly game in McDonald's. He says that he has an unusual prostate condition. I'm not sure if he means he has diabetes or something, but anyway, he says he has an unusual prostate condition, which means that he feels ill if he eats too much, effectively. So he can't eat large portions. But whenever he goes into McDonald's, he goes in wanting a medium-sized portion. He ends up getting a large portion so he can get more Monopoly stickers, whatever they are. And then he feels really ill and he says, I feel bad and McDonald's make more money. It's not fair. Therefore, we should ban any takeaway company from any kind of discounts or promotions. And he's got 18 signatures to his petition, or it did have when I looked at it a few days ago. But it's still possible that the Scottish government may debate this. And it does sound, as we already discussed, it does sound up their street, doesn't it? Well,
Nicola Sturgeon's last acts.
Could well be banning Monopoly.
So let's get to our postbag section where listeners send in their questions for us to answer.
Postbag.
It's bulging, isn't it?
There's one here, Silky, which goes to a lot of what we've been talking about. I'd like to ask the panel how they think popular forums and sites were manipulated by the state to ensure that the message was enforced regarding lockdown and COVID, especially sites like Reddit, whereas ubiquitous, not as sure about Reddit myself. But I suppose just building on a bit of what we were talking about before, you mentioned it there about this kind of trusted flagger status. This is something that you kind of also see with the Twitter files in America, where the issue is that it wasn't just the government make a lot of noise about certain voices they dislike and then they happen to be taken down, that you kind of, it's not just about general pressure. There were direct channels, it seems like, between. Could you say a little bit more about that, about how this kind of, how this actually takes place and what, if any, kind of examples that you've come across in relation to this?
Yeah, so we don't, the government are refusing to publish anything that they ask the social media companies to take down. They won't even tell us the number of things that they ask. You know, was it 20 a day or 2,000 a day? You know, we just don't know. But we deserve to know. And now that we know the kinds of things that they were looking at flagging and recording, certainly a cause for concern. I don't want to overstate what we found. You know, I'm not saying that everything you saw online was controlled by the government, not at all. But I think we should also be clear about the way in which the influence of that kind of so-called counter-disinformation operation would work. If you have even several times as content moderators or as a company that were under enormous pressure during this time, government coming to you saying, this stuff is endangering lives, you know, or this is feeding into a narrative that supports something that, you know, undermines our authority, etc. That one piece of content that the company might then take down could lead to them taking a very cautious, or you could say zealous, censorship approach to all kinds of stuff in that kind of category. And I think that's what happened. Let's also not forget, talking about the World Health Organization, that the policies of social media companies at that time were attuned to the World Health Organization, or in some cases, what they described as local authorities. So,
and if the WHO kept getting things wrong all the time. Said it wasn't airborne, said face masks didn't work, and then kept changing his mind. So one time or other, WHO was the main source of disinformation in the world on COVID.
Yeah, I mean, initially, because of that, Facebook banned advertisements for masks. And
Public Health England got the Advertising Statements Agency to ban face masks.
They said they didn't
do
anything.
And the guy from the NHS said this was irresponsible to make people think they might get some protection from COVID by wearing a bit of cloth over their face.
which is exactly the reason that you need those kind of conversations to happen. So I think that's going on. I think, you know, that kind of like insidious influence of the government position, and the safest thing for the tech companies to do is just to mirror what governments were saying. You know, could it also be that there was more of a proactive propaganda campaign? There was certainly advertising. But I think we've just scratched the surface with this. And also we're looking at policy units. If this is what the policy units were doing, what were the actual spooks doing? Don't know.
And I think there's also big tech has a lot to answer for in this, in how willfully they played the role of kind of outsourced censor. There was a time not that long ago where a lot of these companies would pride themselves on not doing business, particularly with the American state. They, you know, maybe this was a bit of PR involved in this and whatnot, but you know, there would often be kind of flashpoints about the FBI wanting Apple to unlock an iPhone, and they'd make a big stand about it or something like this, or you know, WhatsApp being called to end encryption. They continue to hold the line on that and whatever. But where COVID was concerned, I think where a lot of kind of the alleged misinformation around populist elections and so on is concerned, they would just quite willingly would sort of show up and say, what do you need us to do? And would happily do it for them, it seems like.
The tech companies are basically now like the information wing of Western governments. And Twitter is the only company that is, you know, under Musk, allegedly, possibly going to take a slightly different stance, but I'll believe it when I see it. But effectively, they've been acting at the behest of the UK and US governments.
Definitely. Let's move on to some quick nanny state question here. I see that the Gambling Commission, this is one for Chris here, has applications open to refill its 6 commissioner slots. Chris, you have excellent qualifications. So will you be interested in joining the Gambling Commission? This is from Michael in Gerrard's
Court. I didn't know that. Yes. Yeah, put a good word in for me.
There we go.
I won't be doing an interview. I believe only in getting jobs through frantic networking and the old school tie.
Let me see if there's anything else. Okay, well, just to bring us back to another one of our topics, how significant are Ardern and Sturgeon's resignations in the light of widening opposition to woke politics? We could add to this just their politics in general, I suppose. But Silke, do you see these two figures as kind of similar? A lot of people have compared them, Ardern and Sturgeon. Do you think they represent some kind of politics that is on the way out in some way, shape or form?
Yeah, I mean,
the politics of kindness, Tom. Where's the kindness going to come from now? No Jacinda, no Nicola. We've only got Justin left and that lady in Finland.
It is interesting that this kind of, this profile of, I mean, especially Jacinda, has benefited from this slightly heroic. There's almost like a halo over her legacy, which I'm not sure how is has been earned at all. But, you know, both obviously were operating during very, very unusual circumstances. Some of the biggest challenges governments have ever had, but some of the worst, most authoritarian and harmful decisions that were taken, I'm afraid, I think, particularly in New Zealand. So, you know, and I just actually also don't buy, especially in Jacinda's case, I don't buy the reason given for the resignation. Mm-hmm. And I think to buy it is to actually overlook, again, what a formidable politician she is in some respects, you know, that was actually kind of calculated.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think she resigned?
I think she was lacking in public support, and I think it was a simple political calculation, probably more than, you know, a kind of what it was presented as, and the same for Sturgeon.
So let's finish on this. We've got a question from Andy Mayer, friend of the show.
Yep.
At the IA, of course. Under what circumstances would you go on strike, Chris?
Well, as Andy is the chief operating officer at the IA,
watch what you say.
I would say it's going to take inflation plus 5%. Otherwise, I'm downing tools. And do your own lifestyle economics.
Silke, can you go on strike as the director of an organisation? Would that really work?
I don't think I can, but my goal is for us to be out of jobs, because we live in this kind of like liberal paradise where everything's fine. And then, you know, we would have the right to strike, but we wouldn't even need to be working.
Optimistic note to end on. Silke, Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Last Orders. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Please do take a moment to leave us a rating and a review. And if you'd like to support the show, why not become a Spiked supporter? Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to sign up. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.